To see examples of what we talked about on this episode, along with further information, go to bunchofdorks.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to
Two Dimension Podcast,
the comic book podcast
with no direction.
All right, you heard the song, you know our name. I'm Dallas.
Don.
Al.
Boom, there you go. Welcome back, Two Dimension Comics Podcast. Don always gives me a hard time for actually saying the name, but I had to throw it in there.
It just happened once.
So we're back. Hopefully you guys enjoyed your Halloween. And we got a ton of comics to talk about, I'm pretty sure. Like, Don came in with a massive stack.
Did he really?
Yeah, he did. God. Like, the stack's taller than me. I'm pretty excited about that.
Well, let's get started then.
Well, why not?
All right, gentlemen. I got this book. It's called Two Brothers by Fabio Moon and Gabriel Ba. Now, go
ahead. Are they brothers?
They're twin brothers.
Well, I never would have known because brothers. The names are different.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm guessing these are pen names. Yeah. It's, I heard these two guys, I know Gabriel Bach because he drew Umbrella Academy, which is a book that I saw on MySpace way back. Thought it looked really neat. I found the issue at Demolition Comics. Remember those guys? You know, yeah. I guess he does. Anyway, yeah.
The name sounds familiar. It's a local one.
Yeah, they had a store in Seminole, which Melody told me about. I think they had a Silver Surfer or Spider-Man statue outside in Seminole. And I went. What I liked about the store was I guess they had five locations. And it was kind of a Spartan store, but like my daughter came with me. She bought a 24-hour comics. You know, I had those little manga books.
Those were always so fun, the 24-hour comics.
Yeah, she bought two of those. I got they had several issues of Usagi Yojimbo. This is when I was trying to, you know, fill up the holes.
Which we learned from the last episode that whenever Don gets a pile of new books, he always reads Usagi first.
Yeah, it's one of my favorite books. But anyway, I saw the Umbrella Academy there, the first issue, and I thought I was wanting to see this, so I bought it. And the guy at the store said, "Man, we can't keep these things off the shelf." He says, "Every time I put them out, they just come up." And I said, "Yeah, I was wanting to read it because, yeah, I really like it." He was happy about it.
I mean, your guy actually talked to you? Because I went there a couple of times. The guy was like, "No, I don't have it. No, I don't have it." And he was on a computer and I'm not paying attention to people.
I think it changed because before...
That sounds like horrible customer service.
It was a Spartan store. They had a lot of action figures and stuff.
Yeah, they did. Yeah, they did.
But the thing was, what Melody, my friend, told me was that tell them what you're looking for, and if they don't have it in the store, another store may have it, and they just bring it over at no extra charge. Okay. So I had a whole list of Usagi Yojimbo and other books I was looking for. So I wrote them down and gave them to him. And next thing I came in, they had several of them. And every once in a while I come in, yeah, the other store had this. All right. So it changed over time. Because I remember after a while you go in and the person was always in the back. And they'd see you in, they'd be kind of like, okay. And they come in and wait. But you could see the whole time in the store, like, oh, I wish they'd go inside. I guess
that's
the
way I felt.
Well, I think they were doing work in the back or selling on eBay or something. I don't know what was happening, but it was basically I was taking them away for their work and they were wanting to get back to it. And it did a slow... I know they had one out... some other guy told me they had a store in Tampa he'd drive by. Mm-hmm. By USF. They had like five locations in the area and I guess they closed the stores and the guy just does... I don't know if they have one store left or if they're all online. Nevertheless, Umbrella Academy, I loved. I've heard the two brothers on a word balloon talking. And
I read Umbrella Academy when I worked at Wonderwater Comics, which is a local comic shop. And this
was that long ago?
Yeah, it was around 2000.
You were working with me when Umbrella Academy came out.
No, I want to say. Really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, then maybe I picked it up from Wonderwater Comics, but it seems like it was a long time ago that came out.
No, I knew you for... couple of years.
Okay. Well, I remember reading it, and I was less than impressed at the time. It seemed very sparse to me. I did like the art, and just looking through here, I mean, I love Gabriel Ba's artwork. Mm. In black and white, it looks beautiful. But and I've gone on to like Gerard Way, the writer from Umbrella Academy. I've gone on to like his later stuff, Doom Patrol, obviously, which is a book we read.
Let me explain to you our story in this. I get this book. I read it. I've got like electrical charges going through. I'm like a cartoon character that snorted cocaine. I'm walking around like Kramer. Hey, this is great. I brought it to Dallas all excited. Hey, man, this is really cool. You might want to read it. And then Dallas brings it back the next day, and he couldn't have been less interested in it. And I said, what did you read it? Yeah. it looks like Mignola, it does. It had a Mignola feel, had a wildness to it. I thought it was the greatest. They've done two series. I've always bought it. It's one of my favorites. My friend Britt, I was telling him about it, and he said that, you like that? I said, yeah. I said, you know, I've heard nothing but good things about it. I'm going to go pick it up. He said, people were making fun of it when they heard about it, because, you know, it's a rock star, and they said it was just a vanity project this guy's putting. They said, they say it's really good.
Well, I think that was the perception when it first came out, but, yeah.
It was, like I said, the way I found Umbrella Academy was MySpace. They had a Dark Horse comic section.
Yeah, that was a long time ago.
Yeah, it was a while back, but they had, what was it? They had examples. Well, this is great. It was like every awesome movie I ever liked all rolled into one. It was kind of like X-Men. It was like Highlander. It was, you name it, it was everything. And this one's more like more of a cartoony style. It's a simpler, stylized style. It's a black and white book. I love the cover to it. I love the design to it. The inside, it's a very pattern-oriented black and white, but it's not an absence of color. They're using a lot of black forms and shading. It's not like an absence of color book.
Yeah, it's like there's a lot of masters I know. We were talking about this before, and I think you mentioned Toth is a good example of doing black and white correctly. Yeah. Or
to Hugo where, Pratt.
Yeah, and Hugo Pratt, you know, because they take it, it's an art form, and it's really difficult to just take whites and blacks and make that meld and to create an atmosphere, an ambiance. And you know who else does it well? Well, you'd know is the Hernandez brothers.
Yeah, yeah.
And they do it great on Love and Rockets.
I like those guys in black and white. I like them in color. I've always enjoyed it any way they do. It says here on the cover, I knew it was based on a book somewhere. It says based on the work of Milton Hallowen, who I'm not familiar with. The story is about two brothers in Brazil. The father, I think, is from Lebanon. And the story starts off when these two are talking. It's the two brothers' relationships. And the father is wanting to send the two brothers to school in his home country. And the mother won't have it. So basically, they send one brother to Lebanon, and the other one stays in Brazil. And which is really bizarre. But the relationship was odd. One brother's more of an extrovert. The other brother is an introvert. They get in a fight. One of the brothers scars his brother. You know, I think they're fighting over a woman. Young. They're young. But the whole book is about the relationship. And then as it goes on, they start telling, which it confused me for a bit. They go back in the past, and it shows the father when he came to Brazil and met the mother. And they took over this restaurant. I think the mother's father had a restaurant he always attended. And by this time, the father's running it. And, like I said, I got confused at times. Sometimes I had trouble understanding the motive. And then sometimes I had understanding what exactly was happening. It was always kind of like real life. It wasn't always explained to you. You kind of got bits and pieces, and it's kind of there on the edge of your eye. And you're thinking, I think this is what happened.
It's always kind of gratifying. If you're able to figure it out yourself, it's gratifying that an author isn't talking down to the audience.
Exactly.
Or not dumbing it down for you. But that's a fine line, because then if they don't do it correctly, then you have no way to figure out the story. And, you know, maybe an author thinks they're being clever by not giving you everything, but unless it's written in a coherent way, you won't be able to figure it out.
Well, that's the thing. Sometimes when I read books like that, I don't like it when they ever explain it to me. Sometimes it seems too sophomoric. And if they don't ever explain it
to you. Tell that to Jim Shooter.
Yeah, well, yeah. But sometimes it's just too simple. Sometimes it gets confusing. I never really got confused in it, but sometimes, like, wait a minute. Exactly what are they doing here? Sometimes it's too vague for me. It even started switching, telling different people's perspective of the story, which I did like. It was a sad story. And they were using some shorthand things on how the two brothers, how you could tell them apart even though they were twins. And then when it was finished, I couldn't pick up any insight to finish the story out, like what made me want to read this. When I finished it, I thought, well, that was sad. I'm happy to have the book, but I kind of wanted more.
Would you recommend it?
I would recommend it. I see it at Yancey all the time. Like, man, I've tried to get you to buy it, even though I'm saying all these things about it.
Like you do all the time.
Yeah, I do all the time, but I like it. I'm happy I have it. I pick it up sometimes, look through it again. It's not a book I was upset about. I think they could have tied the end up somehow. I'm left hanging. And it's one of those things where, it's like when I saw the Blade Runner movie in 1982, and I thought that was incredible, and then I walked out of the theater thinking, exactly what happened, you know?
Now, do you think this is necessarily the fault of Fabio Moon and Gabriel Ba? Because on the cover, when it says it's based on the work of this other author,
yeah.
I wonder if how closely they're following his work, and if he had that ending contrived. Maybe it wasn't them. Maybe they were just following his footsteps.
What you're saying is exactly what I'm thinking. But I also have a feeling that that writer probably had some way of finishing the thing out. These two either couldn't do that or they chose not to.
Maybe it just doesn't translate very well in the graphic form.
It's funny because when everyone Word Balloon talking about this book, it just talked about this relationship between the two brothers. It's an undercurrent and it's kind of vile. You know, I mean, it turns to the point where, you know, sometimes you watch some shows and they have like families and the two brothers are always fighting and arguing. This wasn't really an argument, but there's a deep hostility. They can't be around each other. And it's almost a hatred. You know, one brother does really well. The other brother is basically just living off his parents. He's a ne'er-do-well. You know, people know it, but he has a charisma. And people just kind of let that go and forgive him, even though they know he's no good. And he resents that. So the relationship, it affects the two brothers, and it kind of affects the family. You know, you watch the talking about this, I'm starting to realize I like this a lot more than I thought when I read it by myself. But it's rich. It's got a lot of things. It's just that at the end, I thought, well, okay, so they still hate each other, and it's affected everybody, and it's over. You know, there's no... I wasn't expecting the two brothers to finally realize I wasted my whole life hating you and work it out, but I would have liked it better at the end if there was something the narrator or somebody could have said to you just to make you realize what happened and kind of close it off, I guess. But yeah, I actually highly recommend this book, even though I gave it a really horrifying review. And the look of it is par none. It's a beautiful package. These two guys, when they were talking about a Word Balloon, they said that it sounded vile. And then I think it was Fabio Moon said, look, I want to talk about this. This isn't our relationship at all. You could tell the two brothers are really close and got along well. And I think I've even read that, and I may be wrong on this, that they kind of, this is more of Gabriel Ba's look of the book, even though they both drew it and wrote it together. I think they kind of let Gabriel Ba be more of the main presence.
Storyteller.
Yeah. You know, I finished it up. Anyway.
So
yeah,
that was nice, a kind of strong but not so strong review. So I guess...
Yeah, you got to bring us up, Al.
I guess the best thing to do is, like, if there's examples of this online, to have somebody look at it and see if they would want to read it, you know? I mean, because you bought it sight unseen.
Yeah, it was actually Yancey.
You knew the name of the guy from...
Well, I heard him on Word Balloon. I
remember when you bought it. You bought it for half price or something like
did
that.
Did
I? I think so.
Okay, well...
I do want to say the art's gorgeous. And just from that standpoint alone, it looks like it would be worth it. If you enjoy Gabriel Ba's art and if you enjoy that black and white art form, then, I mean, it's a hit.
That's right. I bought it at Free Comic Book Day.
Yeah, and I remember.
But Yancey is sealed. It's sealed.
Yeah, it was
plastic.
Sealed. Yeah, you didn't look at it. You didn't. Yeah, you didn't buy it because you liked it.
You literally did buy it sight unseen. Like, you couldn't even open it up.
Well, yeah. Like I said, I like Gabriel Ba. I've never bought Fabio Moon's work, but I've read some. I've seen examples online, I should say. And I heard him on the interview, and I was interested in it, so I wanted to get it.
Okay.
But and even if I could have seen the inside, I liked the look. I would have bought it. I just like I said, it's just reading the whole thing. When you read Mobius' Airtight Garage, the whole time you're reading that, you're thinking, exactly what is he doing here? And you're going, he keeps going back and forth and back and forth. And towards the end, there's some things, wow, this is something. It sucks you in. But to me, the last two pages, when I get to that and those last two pages happen, I'm thinking, that was incredible. And
it's funny you brought that one up because one of my first exposures to Mobius was The Airtight Garage, but it was released by, I don't remember the comic company, but they released it in a 4-issue series, and I just happened to randomly pick
Marvel or Epic, right?
Probably Epic. But well, I ended up picking up issue 4. Never heard of The Airtight Garage before, and I probably only read maybe one or two things of Mobius before that. So I literally read those last like 15, 20 pages of Airtight Garage. No idea what was going on. But it was beautiful, and yeah, it was, to an extent, it was compelling as far as, you know.
But see, talk about that. Mine was Heavy Metal magazine, and Heavy Metal would print 2, 3, 4 pages of it each time.
Mm-hmm.
And I would pick it up, and I'm like, the first time, I've seen it a couple times, but I couldn't tell what was going on. It was always drawn a different, you know, Mobius can draw any different way he wants.
So you were getting even smaller chunks.
Yeah.
So it must have been even more confusing.
The one that caught me was, it was a man and woman in a giant, remember the Phantom, that newspaper comic strip, the Phantom from Africa? It was a giant robot of him, but he drew him kind of as a black man, you know, the features inside the mask. But they're in his head, working him, and he's running through this desert. And I think they fight a lizard, some giant lizard or monster or something. And then at one point, the woman, you can see the word balloons coming out of the head while he's running. And he goes, oh, I'm hot, do me now. Something, it wasn't that bad, but basically he stops, and you can, you know, they have the Phantom just looking at the camera, and his face is kind of tilted. You see they stop the robot, and they were banging each other. Well, the Phantom caught me. I thought, well, that's kind of neat. But then it finished, and well, what's the point of this? And then the next installment was completely different style. The Phantom's not in it. And that's how I read it. So, and I didn't get Heavy Metal all the time. You see an issue here, you see a copy there, and it was all a hodgepodge. What Mobius did on that book, it was him and another guy had a joke that he wouldn't have a script, and he would just draw a couple of pages and see, you know, it was like a cliffhanger.
Huh.
The thing in France is called The Garage Hermetic of Louis Calwain. And the first couple of pages, it's this character, like with his giant fur coat and pilot's hat. And they got this machine, and she has this weird, he or she has this weird contraption. It looks like a Mobius contraption. And they're saying somebody, they're working on this little engine. And it's just somebody that's Louis Calwain's. And then they hit the button, and it zaps the machine and destroys it. And, well, Louis Calwain's going to kill me. I destroyed his machine. And it ended there. Well, the next one, it shows this person on the run, trying to get away. And it just keeps going and elevating. And it's just one corner the person's in. Mobius finishes. And then the next installment, he's trying to get that person out. And what are you going to do? He changes the style. He changes the scope. All these people come in. All these people are going around. And when
it sounds like it's just kind of an exercise in serial storytelling. I'm sure. It sounds like Mobius had a lot of fun just doing it.
It was. But that's when I was reading the Mobius work, I never remembered that fondly. I just remembered Heavy Metal magazine. It was a mess. The Inkle was what brought me in. The Long Tomorrow, some of this work. And then every time when Epic was putting these short stories out, they kept bringing up how much Archie Goodwin loved the Airtight Garage and all these other garage. Oh, the Airtight Garage. I thought these people are insane. Airtight Garage sucked. Well, it was the third Epic Mobius graphic novel, so I bought it. I read through it. The whole time, I'm like, I don't know. And like I said, the last two pages, I'm like, oh, that was genius. All of a sudden, the whole thing, it's like if you have a bunch of drummers and they're all playing different beats all at the same time. Well, the 12th beat always lands at the same time. And that was, the very end was like the 12th beat, you know. But nevertheless, going back to Two Brothers, I didn't find that ending.
Wow, man. The way you circled around was brilliant. It's funny that you happened to bring up the Phantom, the old Lee Falk comic character. When I was a kid, I want to say I was probably like 6-7 years old, I used to collect the Phantom Sunday strips and the... What's the King Arthur book? Prince Valiant.
Yeah.
The Prince Valiant Sunday strips and the Phantom Sunday strips, I would cut them out of the newspaper every Sunday and I would paste them into a big notebook I had. And so I'd have these like fat notebooks of like a couple of years worth of Phantom stories and a couple of years worth of the Prince Valiant stories. And I really wish I still had them.
Oh, you don't have them anymore?
That was kind of my first exposure. That was when I first started collecting or even becoming aware of comic books.
Yeah.
You know, it was around that time. It was probably within a year or so of that happening. And so that was my way of kind of collecting my own comic strips since I couldn't always go to a comic shop and get the books. And I used to love sitting down and just reading those collected Sunday strips.
What was the first comic shop you went to? Jim Johnson's?
No. Well, you know, it might have been because I first became aware of comics probably I was 6 years old up in St. Louis, Missouri. And saw them at like a convenience store or a local store with the spinner racks.
You were still in that.
Right, so I was picking up a couple little books like The Transformers, and there were a couple other things. And then when we moved to Florida when I was 7 years old, my brother and my dad happened to be driving around getting to know the city, and my brother came back, and my brother was 10 years older than me, so he was 17 at the time. He's like, Dallas, there's this, I found a comic book store, I know you're into comic books, you gotta go check this out. And they have the books, and they even have the covers that come with them. And I'm thinking, in my mind, what my brother meant was the plastic sleeves, you know, the poly bags.
Oh.
He was calling them covers. And I'm thinking, wait, so the comics don't come with covers unless you get them special? Like, I was incredibly confused. And I remember going to, that comic shop and it turned out to be Jim Johnson's shop. So that might've been the actual standalone, the first LCS that I ever went to. And I think the first comic I ever bought there was a Ninja Turtle comic, the Eastman and Laird Ninja Turtle comic books.
So when you were back in St. Louis, you used to go to convenience stores?
I'd go to a convenience store and pick up, like, my little Transformers comics.
Oh, that's kind of cool.
My first exposure. And then, like I said, as far as I can remember, it was Jim's comic shop.
Did your brothers have any hand-me-down comics or anything?
No, you know what my oldest brother, the one I was just mentioning? No, you know what he did, though, to some of my comics? I remember back in St. Louis, he had a school project. He must have been the 10th grade. He had to make, like, a big... like just a big collage of advertisements, and he had to have a theme. So while I was at school, he thumbed through all my comic books and cut out a bunch of the ads, thinking I wouldn't care. And I remember coming home and crying, like screaming to my mom, saying, you know, he cut out my comic books. And I was freaking out.
So. No, if you have a sibling, that happens. A friend of mine I was in the Navy with, that book, Where the Wild Things Are. Yeah, I've always loved it. I had a copy on the ship. And my friend was telling me, he came from a family of 8 kids. And he said one day they had that book in the house. And he says, one day I was thinking about it, I wanted to read it again. And I couldn't find it. And I went and asked, I says, anybody know where that book, The Wild Things Are? And then he found it later when his older sister, she cut it up for a school project. Well, it wasn't a malicious thing. It's like Dallas said, well, it's just the ads. Why would he care? But
on the other side of the ads was the actual comic
pages. Yeah, exactly. You know. But it happens when you have a sibling. That's just life.
See, I never had any siblings. But if they did that to me, my response to it would have been malicious. For sure.
Well,
like, you...
When I'm saying
that's
this,
my stuff.
When I'm saying this, when these things happen, when Dallas talks, he's crying, tells his mom upset. Mine, I wouldn't even want to discuss. I was throwing things. I was wanting to kill. It is horrifying. I'm not excusing that, but I'm saying that.
Where the Wild Things Are is one of my daughter's favorite books. We have
really?
We have a few. She's got a big bookshelf full of, like, you know, children's books. But there's only maybe a small handful of books that we go to every night because we read her 2 or 3 books every night before she goes to bed. We have, like, a little routine, and that's part of it. And, At least twice a week, we read Where the Wild Things Are, because I've always loved that book.
Yeah, me too.
And Emily, my daughter, just fell in love with it. She loves it because there's that part, the wild rumpus starts, and we always, like, kind of dance and sing to the part where all the wild things are dancing, and we just have a good time of it.
You know, to this day, I was 7 when I found it at the school library. It was the second book I checked out. And I remember when I went in there, as soon as I opened the book, I could hear drums in the distance. To this day, if I pick it up, I hear doom, 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 doom. You know, It's one of those things where it's not just, I liked it because I'd always try to draw the wild things, the monsters in it. But every time I'd read it, it just sucked me right into that world. And like mm-hmm. I said, my daughter loved it. But I had a teacher in high school, she was wanting to do a project with me, I was going to illustrate it. And she brought up that she did not want to do anything like that book, a war book, Where the Wild Things Are. She said it was just like spitting when she said it. And this is a teacher I thought the world of. And I told her that was my favorite book. You know, I mean, absolutely. And she just can't get pissed. She thought the monsters were horrible. She wouldn't let her students check it out, which is wrong. But and I've read about that, that some teachers and stuff are trying to get that taken out of the library, which is wrong. But to me, that book is nothing but just awesomeness.
It's wonderful. It's fantastic. It's imaginative. Not only the monsters, not only the idea of it, but the poeticness of it. Just the way, who is it, Maurice Sendak, I think is the name of the guy? The way he writes it is wonderful.
And the way he lays the book out, because when it starts, it's kind of short, and then the artwork on each page spreads out. And finally, we get to where the wild things are. There's four pages of him with the wild things dancing around with no words. And then after it passes, the pages start shrinking from the other side till he gets home.
That's awesome. That's I never really noticed that, but I can totally see it in my head now.
It's on every level. You know, that book was supposed to be about horses.
What?
It was supposed the wild things were horses.
Oh, okay.
And I said, why in the world did he draw monsters? Because he couldn't draw horses very well, so he turned into monsters.
That's so funny. Look how endearing that book has become. Yeah, and a lot of it because of the look of it, because of the look of the monsters.
And I'm just thinking, I wonder if it was horses, if we'd be talking about it right now.
Okay, on that note, let's... sorry, I just brushed Don's leg. Let's take a musical break. We'll be right back.
Lights on only your eyes. Your Dimension can be found on iTunes and Stitcher Radio. If you like what you hear, you can subscribe, rate, leave a review, tell a friend, or like us on Facebook. Thanks for listening.
And that was a band called Disperse. I'm a huge fan of the guitarist. His name is Jacob Zytecki. The first name is spelled J-A-K-U-B. If you guys are interested in any kind of guitar or kind of experimental and ambient style of guitar playing, I'd highly recommend checking out his two solo albums. We'll put all that information in the show notes so you guys can check it out. All right, so we had some technical difficulties on the second half of this episode. After we recorded it, I lost the file for the second half. So Don and Al were kind enough to get back together and record a new segment for the second half of this show. So I'm going to send you guys over to them. So Don, take it away.
And thank you, Dallas. And Al's got something that he wants to talk about.
I think so. I think I want to talk about it. It seems like I'm getting a weird vision that we've done this before, or whatever. But anyway, I was going through my trades, and I found this Mighty Crusaders, Origin of a Super Team. Well, those are those, like, Archie or MLJ or whatever they are, 60s, kind of like decided to do their take on camp superheroes. I seem to remember there was a paperback called, like, something like Camp Superheroes or something.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and it was like the, the Shield, the Black Hood.
Flyman.
The Comet. Yeah. The Fox isn't one of them, is he? Was the Fox part of it, or was he created later for... Did Toth create the Fox, or was that one of the original MLJ guys?
I don't know. Well, I think...
I don't remember.
I never heard of these guys when I was, it was a 19...
Steel Sterling.
Yeah. It was Christmas of 1971. I was really heavy into comic books by that time. And for Christmas, my mom bought me a board game called The World's Mightiest Heroes, I think is what it's called. And the board game had these superheroes that I'd never seen before. It was the Shield, the Black Hood, Flyman, Flygirl. I think it was a character called the Jaguar. Yeah, well, on the cover,
it was a Jag.
It was Mr. Jag. And there was also one called Mr. Flag, which he's not in any of these, but he was another red, white, and blue guy with red and white striped cape. But I never heard of them. They looked kind of neat, and the board was really neat because it had all these characters circled around. The goal of the thing was to get to Secret City. And I know friends of mine, when they see that game, all they talk about was trying to find Secret City. But on the board itself, I kept saying, what are these things? It was copyright 1966. And it said Archie Publications Incorporated or something. Yeah. And like I said, at that point, I was 10. And I wouldn't touch Archie Comics with a 10-foot pole. It was like, I don't know, like...
Girls.
Like going to the girls' underwear department or something, you know? It's like there was a stigma to it. And
I mean, you didn't enjoy wearing Angora sweaters like Ed Wood or anything like that?
But, you know, I kept thinking, what are these? Archie? And as soon as I saw Archie, I kept thinking maybe I shouldn't even have this in my room. But I get aggravated because when I did start reading Archie comics in high school, every once in a while they'd have a little... There was a cover, a Dan DiCarlo cover, where they're outside a movie theater, and there's a movie poster behind them, and it's the Shield, you know, punching the guy out.
Yeah.
You know, that's that one from the game. And I thought, so that is real. And it was in one of the digests, it was You Know You're a Superhero If. It was like a 2 pages. And... They had Jughead, Archie, you know, Betty, Veronica. They were all dressed up as these characters. And one of them, Archie, was dressed as a Shield. And it said, you know you're a superhero if you're pulled over for speeding and you're a pedestrian. And Archie was dressed as a Shield, but he has smoking feet and, you know, flames behind him. And I kept thinking, why don't they ever publish these things? These are good characters. And later, Fred Hembeck wrote about the fly and told the whole story, which that was Simon and Kirby. That's about all I knew. And then every once in a while, I would it was in the 80s when they brought him back as Red Circle again. And Rich Buckler was in charge. Oh, yeah. You got that too.
Yeah, I got the trade paperback.
The New Crusaders Legacy.
Those are the 80s ones, yeah. A lot of cool people. Rich Buckler, of course, Alex Toth, Trevor Von Eden.
Yeah, he's great.
Let's see who else was in here. Edward Barreto. Let's see here. Keep thinking that Mark Teixeira did something, but that was later on. I think Dick Ayers did some stuff. Alex Nino, forgot about him. He did the comment, I believe. These were fun, man. Yeah, they came out for a little while. You know, Tony DeZuniga did Steel Sterling. They came out for a little while, and then Archie never gave them much of a. They didn't give them much of a shot. You know, for like a year or two. That was the run with the infamous. Wasn't that the Private Life of Captain Strong, where like Rich Buckler just swiped the entire Jack Kirby page?
That's right. You and me and Rook had talked to us in the past. I looked that up because that was in Amazing Heroes or the Comics Journal, and the guy that wrote it, as we said, Comics Journal could be really mean spirited, far beyond what you know. And the guy that wrote that up, he was in. To me, I'd say deservedly so. It was blatant what he did. But that write-up, he was harsh. And when I was putting the show together, I looked at it. It was hard to find. You know, I did finally find some stuff along that lines. This guy wrote a blog. But I guess Rich Buckler sued Comics Journal for that. And Comics Journal relented. And Rich Buckler's comment was, that he was trying to do it as close as Jack Kirby as he could as a homage. And I thought, well, all right. But no, he actually traced characters. And then he changed backgrounds. Like he took different characters out and put other ones in, and he rearranged things. But, I mean, it wasn't like he was just drawing and following some of it closely. He traced. And when I say that, not as well. It was a hack job.
Well, the thing about Rich Buckler, the late Rich Buckler, was he was a fine artist, except he was a man with no style. He was just like a mimic of other styles. He was a damn good one, too. You know, when he did his Kirby thing, it was a good Kirby thing. When he did his Neil Adams thing, it was a real good Neil Adams thing. I've got some early 70s Warren books, Creepy or Eerie or whatever, where he does them in the style of, like, you know, Angelo Torres or whatever, you know, more of that. Typical style or whatever, rather than when the superhero stuff, but he was very good, you know, but he was kind of like all over the place with his style, you know, so.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, and the thing was, I really liked his Fantastic Four he did in the Kirby style. I mean, I really enjoyed those, and then he did Giant Size Avengers 1. To this day, it's one of my favorite comics. But I didn't really care for his Neil Adams and his John Buscema style as much. And
that's right, he did do John Buscema.
Those are the three he had a feel for, but even the Fantastic Four, after a while, he started getting sloppy, like lazy with it. You know, I mean, it wasn't the same as the earlier issues from, like, you know, 74 and stuff. After a while, it was kind of lackadaisy, which tends to happen. The Red Circle stuff they did in the early 80s, I didn't like. I was really disappointed. I didn't like how they were packaged. I looked through them, and it just seemed like the books, there was no editorial thought to them. They were just kind of slapped together.
Rich Buckler was the editor, I think.
Yeah, he was the editor-in-chief. Or, I don't know, editor-in-chief. He was the art director. So
he was a big shot in the books.
But I'm looking through this trade you got. These are the same stories, but it's a great package. And, you know, they're colored. They're on really nice paper. And that's a big difference, but I mean, this is it's a big chunk of comics. It's fun.
Those were fun comics.
But when I see these in the dollar boxes, I'm thinking.
You never got them?
No. I didn't buy them when they were in the stands, and they sat on the stands in 83.
I bought them off the stands.
But I bought two of them. We talk all the time, the second, third issue of Black Hood.
Yeah, well, yeah.
Alex Toth did a wraparound cover for each issue. And then, who was the guy that did the Black Hood stories, Jerome? Was it Tom Sutton or Dan Spiegel?
I have to look that up. Let me go to my little machine that tells me, little magic thing. I don't think it was either.
Okay, I didn't like the front stories. You did, you said, but the backup story for both those issues was I think it was a 6 or 8 page story by Alex Toth of the Fox.
Yes.
And those things were just unbelievable.
Yeah, I'm trying to figure out who did. I remember, you know, there was also, I think we talked about it before, a little digest that had a Neil Adams story, too, I believe, of the Black Hood. That was only, really, I don't think it got into a comic book. I think it was a digest story or whatever. And it was pretty great, actually, you know, but I'll have to look and see. I don't remember who drew the Black Hood stories. But the Fox was definitely the standout one of all of them. That's the one that stood out the most. Well, Toth going crazy. And we'll talk about Toth at some point, about how he would change scripts, scripts or whatever. But
those Fox stories, Alex Toth wrote them, too. I never really thought of him as a writer.
He wrote them, okay, yeah.
And they were unique. I mean, they were both just absolutely unique, and I never forgot them. And it's just odd to be in a backup story that you remembered so fondly. And the internet was around, I'd look things up, and some guys would talk about some of their favorite comics as these odd backup stories of the Fox that Alex Toth did. I mean, it wasn't just me. And then when, what's that guy, Dean Haspiel, when he was doing the Fox, that series? He was talking about, it was just two stories, but everybody remembers them, and it was the Alex Toth. Everybody from that time period, it just imprints in your mind.
Oh, sure, yeah.
But I'm looking at these, again, the ones from the 80s, this is a really nice comic, and it has the feel, I guess, for the old ones. This first one, The Mighty Crusaders, Origin of Super Team.
That's all by Paul Reiman.
Tell me a little bit about him.
Oh, he was an artist, and he was a Golden Age artist. Remember, he inked a few Kirby Fantastic Fours back in the early 60s after Dick Ayers, I think. Remember Paul Reiman did some of them?
No, I don't remember.
Really never name. Saw him? Yeah.
Well, I mean, I've seen them. I've read them, but I just didn't.
He did some inks on Kirby, and then he did a lot of work for ACG. And then around the same time, I guess Archie hired him to do all the, you know, the Mighty Crusaders, you know. And they have that Kirby feel to them.
It reminds me a lot of Mike Sikowski when he did Legion. Justice League.
Yeah, but it really does look like since I think he was probably inking Kirby at the time, he probably got a lot of the feel to him or whatever, you know?
Yeah, well, actually, these are really neat. They're fun. But they're treating them like a Justice League. I didn't remember the Red Circle stuff in the 80s where they were really a team. It's just a bunch of individual books. Yeah, this reminds me like Mike Sikowski, but it does have that Kirby feel.
There's a bunch of Black Hoods, man. I'm looking through Wikipedia now. I can't find who drew the book in the 80s, but like there's a ton of people here involved in it. Let's see, the Black Hood. Yeah, the Black Hood. Okay, here you go. The Black Hood was revived by artist Gray Morrow during his stint as an editor at Archie's Red Circle's comics line in the early 70s, and was first published years later in Archie's Superhero Comic Digest number 2, the one that I'm talking about. In these stories, the Black Hood second incarnation, Thomas Kip Berlin, was given the secret identity by his uncle, the first Black Hood, who revealed that the family had in fact used the pseudonym throughout history. Okay.
So they turned into a legacy character like the family.
And then after that, Impact Comics picked them up and did the, that one when DC got the MJ guys for a little while and did absolutely nothing with them, you know.
Well, you say that, but I bought them, one issue of The Fly, Mike Parabek.
Those were good.
Yeah, Mike Parabek drew it. And
those were good.
They were fun, lighthearted books. They were supposed to be, I guess, for, you know, preteen readers, but I bought one, and the kid was the fly, and I guess he was learning. It was a new one, and it was just so much fun and upbeat. I never found another issue. I found them since in, you know, cutout boxes and stuff over the years. But I really like The Fly. Mike Parabek went on to do that Batman Adventures comic.
He was great.
You know, the animated.
Yeah, he's great.
But those were fun stories and, you know, nicely drawn. And then they had, I bought a couple issues of The Comet, which I didn't like as well. But I remember the store I went to, I told the guy I really liked The Fly.
Well, you know, during take one of this show, what was it that you called the Comet's costume? You said something like he looked like, you know, the...
oh, he's all rainbow.
He looked like a gay spokesman for a Florida orange juice.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Like
I did see that.
Something bizarre like
yeah.
that.
Yeah, who is this character?
That's the Comet, isn't it?
Oh, okay. God, he looks... Yeah, that's right. I did see that. Because I was looking, trying to figure this guy. The Comet was always a dark blue and red character every time I saw him. And... in the Impact comics. In this one, he's orange and green, and he's got a pencil mustache, and he's got a motorcycle helmet with a rainbow stripes going across on each side. And he's got a cape and a high collar, I think. And he's just, but that's what I said, he looked like the gay hero for an orange juice company.
For orange juice.
Yeah. But, yeah.
You know, the original Black Hood in the 40s, they had a couple of artists, but I know one of them was Harry Lucy.
Yeah, that's right.
Harry Lucy drew some of those, and they were fantastic, too.
That's something that blows my mind, was that Harry Lucy did superhero comics quite well. That's one thing I thought it was always Archie, and they just started having them, you know, the superheroes are big, let's do some of those. I couldn't have been more wrong. When the internet came out and I started looking things up, MLJ was the publishing company. I think it was the initials of the men that started
it. Was it the guys?
I think it was three men. But they had a comic called Pep, and they had the Fox and the Shield, the Black Hood and the Shield. And there's old issues of Pep where it's three characters in the cover. It's the Shield, the Black Hood, and in the center is Archie on a unicycle. And I guess...
Now, Harry Lucy was the guy in The Hangman. I'm getting it confused with some. I'm thinking it might have been... Maybe Harry Lucy did do some of the...
I think he did.
But I know he was involved with The Hangman.
And I think Bob... Didn't Bob Montana do some of those superheroes?
I don't know. I don't know. I never heard that before.
I'm guessing, because he was the one that did Archie. And Archie and Jughead were really thuggish looking. And I mean, really thuggish looking. And the girls didn't... It's not the Archie stuff that we saw that, you know, Harry Lucy and Dan DiCarlo and all that were doing later. They were kind of shady.
Yeah.
But,
Oh, here's a great Hangman cover here. I want to save this to use it as... It's definitely Harry Lucy. I'll save it for the show. It's really good.
Cool. But like I said, I'm looking through this old book. There's, it reminds me, like Al said, of old Jack Kirby when he was with Joe Simon, but also really Mike Sikowski looking. But it's it looks like a fun 60s comic.
Yeah, they are. At the time, it was like, these were just like, you know, third rate, second rate or whatever. But now you look at them fondly because it's like, well, you know, I never gave them a shot back then. You
yeah.
know, it's kind of like, I should have tried harder to enjoy them. But they're fun books, man. I have a few issues or whatever. I don't know where they are. Obviously, everything's boxed up. But I found some issues of, whatchamacallit, the Super Teen and Pure Heart, They're Powerful and all that. You know, and Archie, the characters actually became superheroes in the comic books. I found some of my old ones that I got when I was a kid. Those are a lot of fun, too. I'd like to see them put those out as a trade paperback.
Didn't DC do the Mighty Crusaders? Didn't they license them for a while?
They did do it when they had the Impact line. Yeah, I think there was a Mighty Crusaders book.
But somebody else, I think, tried to do them again, or Archie brought them back another time.
Boy.
Besides the 80s.
Yeah.
You know, that's one problem. I always say this. DC bought the Fawcett stuff, Captain Marvel.
Yeah, they bought it outright, though. They didn't lease it or anything like that.
Yeah, they bought it outright. And, I really enjoyed, because I'd see Captain Marvel on stuff, but I didn't know what he was. And I didn't know the whole lawsuit where DC stopped Captain Marvel from being published. But what got me was when DC did buy the rights, they did a new book.
Yeah, it says in 2012, Archer returned to the Mighty Crusaders characters, the new Crusader. Yeah, Archie, you're right. Archie redid them all over again.
But the Captain Marvel stuff DC was doing, they were also publishing tons and tons of reprint stories, which I really enjoyed.
Mm.
But then in the 80s, after Crisis, they tried to bring Shazam, you know, that comic back. And I didn't buy it. They were trying to make it, you know.
Yeah. Wasn't it Jerry Bingham drawing it or somebody?
I never bought it. I just remember I didn't like the cover because it was him and he was kind of brooding, you know. And I think he couldn't see his eyes. Like he had the X-Men, you know, or Batman mm-hmm. blind eyes.
Yeah.
And C.C. Beck wrote about it. And I'm guessing Comics Journal because he used to write. But he said, all I see is another superhero with a bad haircut. Because his hair was all slicked back. But the thing was, it's like they completely lost the whole spirit of the character. Mm-hmm. And I understand, like, you know, Marvel Man, you know, Alan Moore rewrote it, you know, and brought it, bring it to modern times. But it was still an homage to the old stuff, even though he changed it. For like these Mighty Crusaders, I'm looking at this one from the 60s. It has a fun superhero feel to it.
Yeah.
And whereas a lot of times they try to bring it back, it's like, I don't know, they try to bring it to modern times. They try to make it dark and gritty, and it's just not fun. You know?
No, it's not. No, it's not. But, you know, what are you going to do? That's just the times that we live in.
That's something also, we were talking about Mr. Miracle, and we mentioned the Steve Rude, you know, Mark Evanier book. Dallas, like we all are, is a massive Steve Rude fan. And he said, I'd like to read it. So I brought it into work, and, you know, he read it. He loved it. But I never thought about it. I always thought that when Crisis on Infinite Earths, after that came out, that's when everything went dark and gritty. But it didn't, because I remember when I bought that that Miracle Man, Steve Rude book, at the time, it's when John Byrne was doing Superman, which is still a comic book kind of thing. It wasn't Dark Knight or Watchmen.
No, it wasn't. No.
And there was a bunch of books that DC was putting out. Alan Davis and Mike W. Barr was doing Detective Comics, and it was kind of like a 66 Batman and Disney. You know, it was fun.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of Blue Beetle was out with Paris Collins was drawing it. There was mm-hmm. a lot of fun, you know.
Yeah, there still was in the 80s.
Mainstream books. I hate to say it, but it was basically when the Image books started coming out.
Watchmen.
Well, Watchmen was in 86, but, you know, these books were like 86 and 87 I'm talking about.
Yeah.
But they were still more like this Mighty Crusaders book you got from the 60s. They still had that. They were treating, and when I say this, I was just as guilty. I remember after Dark Knight, I really, you know, I was, you know, Superman and Batman when I grew up were best friends. They were super friends. And then when Dark Knight, it showed them at odds, political thinking and philosophy and, you know. But that's, when they were starting to do it in the mainstream comics, they were kind of playing it off like the two were always at odds, which was interesting. It was kind of fun. It was different. Those old DC comics, after a while, just more of the same. It got boring. But it was, I'm guessing, the late 80s is when everything started getting psychotic.
Two guys, yeah. Frank Miller, well, not two guys, but main two guys in my brain only, Alan Moore and Frank Miller. They're the ones who, you know, darken everything up, you know what I mean? That's definitely Dark Knight, obviously. Dark
oh, yeah.
Knight. And then, you know, the Watchmen stuff.
Well,
know?
Alan Moore talked about that.
And then he tried to do the ABC 1963 line. Books
yeah.
to counteract...
I read that somebody said he felt really bad about what happened. And I've heard him on Fanboy Radio. He said that was never Dave Gibbons and his intention was...
No.
He said they were thinking people start taking away storytelling ideas and stuff they did. He says instead we just got a long line of, you know, dark, psychotic superheroes.
Yeah.
And he says that was never their intention. But
I mean, can you trace it back to maybe Neil Adams with his the revived Batman?
Well, see, we always talk about that. I do. There was something to that because every time people talked about comic books, it was always flipping. You know, when Jack Kirby was on Entertainment Tonight, everything's, well, you may not know this, they kept talking, but this guy created all the, you know, but it was all zany. And then they had all those, you know, sound effects in the background. Well, that's not respect. But anytime people talked about comic book on television or an interview, it was always that slam bang kind of thing.
Sure.
And then you'd read, I mean, I say this, even Jim Aparo's, you know, Brave and the Bold, and especially the Spectre stories you and I both like, those were dark, but there was, it was
another one.
But it wasn't the same as some of the stuff that they started going on where they're just psychotic and constant. It was, there was something to it that was still neat.
Yeah.
But like I said, even after, I thought after Watchmen and Dark Knight, all this stuff changed, but it didn't. Comics were still, there was a lot of fun,
yeah,
mainstream.
It didn't, but a seed was planted.
Yeah, a seed was planted, but it was the late 80s when it started.
The Brits came in and really darkened everything up.
Well, they were doing some, even at that time, but I, like I said, to me, it was after Image Comics came out. You know, I mean, I want to say that those guys are creating Marvel Comics, and they were doing some of that, but it seemed like after the founders of Image Comics, when those comics started coming out, that's when everything changed and got, you know.
Yeah, to me, those were kind of like dopey, you know? I mean, there wasn't any, like, when you say dark, it meant, like, not just dark, dark themes, you know, real negativity, and characters that were bright and funny are now, like, you know, grim and mean and nasty, whereas those guys were just doing whatever takes they were, and they were new characters.
Yeah.
You know, they were their own characters.
When I say that, all the DC and Marvel stuff kind of got fascist, like a bunch of fascists and fascists in spandex. Spandex and leather. I mean,
yeah, I mean, there's a lot of that stuff going on, you know, but it's just like, you know, it's like, it's in the movies too, you know. The Batman movie did a lot. That darkened everything up. It became all grim and gothic.
Well,
and,
see, that's another one right there. When I, you know, again, as I always say, call me a hypocrite, but I was excited reading about the Batman movie.
Yeah.
When Tim Burton was doing it, and I explained to people what it was, and they were talking about, they were talking about getting William Dafoe or Jack Nicholson as the Joker. And I thought, so it won't be that zany, you know, 66 TV show, Adam West. And,
which is why when you see, like, a show, when you used to watch a show about comics, you'd see the Adam West,
zaps. And that's how they always treated it.
Yeah.
But I was excited about the Batman movie, and then as it was coming out, I lost more and more interest. And, I mean, they treated it with respect, but, I don't know, one, he couldn't even turn his head. There was no action. There was a guy in a suit that couldn't move. And to me, people love it, and it's fine. And it opened it up, and it changed it. You know, that's when you started doing superhero movies kind of seriously.
Yeah.
But I don't know. It was like everything that I loved about comics wasn't in that movie. You know, and even
talking about the Burton one.
Yeah, the
not
the Burton
66 one.
Well, I like that show.
Yeah, I do too.
It had a stigma to it, though.
Yeah, it does. By fans. When the fans started taking over, fandom wasn't like a big deal, when it was just kids buying comic books off the stand, it was like, oh, yeah. And after you grew up, you go, oh, that's kind of fucking dopey.
Like I said, that's why
fandom really, like,
well, it wasn't just fandom. But, like, my problem was, is again, Jack Kirby was on Entertainment Tonight. But they didn't treat it like this guy came up with all the stuff that goes through and, you know, all the big ideas.
No.
All they were was flipping, you know, the whole time. And that was the problem with comic books, is all of a sudden they were just silly fodder. And I guess that's what gets me, is I was in the Navy and, you know, I always bought and read comics. And some of the guys in the ship, can I read those? Oh, yeah, sure. And then they get excited. I remember going back to Walt Simonson's Thor, you know, one guy was reading them after I bought them, and he was so excited about Thor turning into a frog.
He didn't bend the pages back.
No. They always treat him with respect. I had no problems with that.
Okay.
But he, you know, sometimes he'd read them, and this one guy on the ship, he said, why don't you read something more educational? Again, he just dismissed it, which irritated me.
Like Playboy.
Yeah. But, you know, like I said, I never worried about it. What's funny is that guy, that's all he talks about now is those Marvel movies. He goes on, oh, man, have you seen, I love those. They were all in the comic books when we were in the Navy. And he's, you know, again, the stigma comes up. You know, comic books are just trash.
Yeah.
But those same people can't wait. You know, they wear all the T-shirts. They go to Universal Studios to do the Marvel thing and, but yet they wouldn't read those comic books.
Hey, today when I was returning the rental car, the guy brought me back. he goes, yeah, you know, I got free HBO this weekend, and I watched that Batman versus Superman movie, and he's like, you know, it seems stupid to me that Batman could actually beat Superman. You know, Superman can move worlds, can do that, and Batman's like, now he's got a thing, a armor, but before he was just an acrobat guy. And we were talking about, like, the way comics were. He's like a, he bought comics when they were a dime, he said, but he had all the early, he said he had the early Marvels. Of course, his mother threw them out, right. You know. Because he really loved the Sergeant Rock, Sergeant Fury, and the Enemy Ace. And I go, oh, those are damn good, you know, books, too, mm-hmm. or whatever. But it was funny, you know, and he was from Queens in New York. So I was like, okay, you know, that's cool. You know,
but, you know, that's the other
But even
thing.
People see that. They see these movies, and they go, yeah, it's... You know,
well,
this
that's
is what I
again,
remember.
Going back to Dark Knight, because Batman and Superman were best of friends. But Batman had no chance against Superman. It was never even thought. And I remember when, you know, DC and Marvel crossed over and did that Superman, Spider-Man, that oversized edition, which was awesome. Well, then later they followed it up in, what was it, 1981 with Batman versus the Hulk.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was at the convention. John Byrne was there in Oklahoma City, and he was talking about it. And I thought, Batman and the Hulk. And somebody said, well, why don't they do Batman and Captain America? And which is what would have made more sense. And then John Byrne said, that's what I said. And he says, but they said the audience was no more because Batman and the Hulk had their own TV shows. Okay, I see the logic of that. But they never said, what's Batman going to do against the Hulk? And then John Byrne made a joke about he'll have Hulk repellent spray, you know. But that's what it seemed like. Batman was great, but he wasn't the same. But when Dark Knight, when he fought Superman and he shot Superman with kryptonite and he had that suit of armor and he beat him. And when you're reading that back then in 86, you're like, my God, Batman beat Superman. But it wasn't flipping. It was serious, and it was like, Batman put his life on the line. He put everything he had into fighting it. And after that, Batman fights Superman all the time. I'm thinking, that's not the same thing. There's a lot of tactics and planning and, you know, resources and everything he used.
Yeah.
You know, Darma Cook did that in New Frontier. They had a newspaper page where it showed Batman and Superman fighting, and I had this smoke. And then later when New Frontier came out on DVD, they did a special edition, you know, comic, and had a story of Superman and Batman and Wonder Woman, and Batman really did fight Superman, but it was more the same. He had a sliver of kryptonite, and he kept, you know, using the Batmobile and whatever he had, taking Superman, you know, disappearing, coming back, striking him, and
yeah.
He never really took Superman out, but he aggravated him really bad, and then Superman was getting ready to kill him. But he hurt Superman, and then Wonder Woman showed up and stopped it. And then they just took that picture where he had like a purple smoke bomb just to, you know, put it forth that Superman and Batman fought for the news. That was neat. But yeah, mm-hmm. They're fighting all the time. They did that movie, which I've never seen. I couldn't tell anything about. But
anyway, getting back to something that I wanted to talk about before, and thankfully I remembered. You were talking about how the Fox was one of your favorite backup strips.
Yes.
My, you know what mine was? Carson of Venus.
Yeah.
Korak.
You know, it's something Scott Connor talks about all the time, and you and I have talked about. I've always wondered why they never reprinted those.
Yeah, exactly.
And Scott Connor said that they can't... hi, Scott. But
ERB yeah. for because of ERB.
No, it wasn't that. It was they said there just wasn't enough material to put in a trade. And I guess they were talking about mixing it with, you know, some of the Weird World stuff or something. But, you know, to me, I love Mobius's parable, you know, about the Silver Surfer. It was two issues.
Yeah, yeah. They made that into a...
Yeah, well, they had a trade, you know, a really expensive hardback. And then later they put it out with this really long Keith Pollard and Stan Lee Silver Surfer story, which I had no interest in reading. But then I went to the comic store one day, and they put those two issues out on really nice paper for a special price. And Marvel did that with several different books. I'm thinking, why couldn't they just put it out in a really nice single issue, you know, on nice paper? That would be perfect. But no, they don't have the license anymore, but I guess Dark Horse has the license to that stuff now, or had.
Do they?
Or they had it, I guess, at one point.
I don't keep up with all that stuff.
But, no, I would like to see that. But anyway, after we talked about the Mighty Crusaders, and I was looking things up, and like I said, Dallas was reading that Mr. Miracle from 86, there was still a lot of...
light.
Well, I was going to say lighthearted, but they weren't flippant. You know, the creators were treating this like they were good stories. You know, they were interesting, they had conflict, they were serious, they could be adult, you know, but they weren't just dark, psychotic, sewer-ridden heroes walking around, you know, slicing everything up. So there was still a lot of that going on, which I didn't realize, you know.
So. Yeah, you forgot, because some of those 90s and 80s books are forgettable.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and believe me, I have boxes of them right there. I'm probably going to be taking a Wilson soon. So we should do a show of the 80s and 90s shows and see if anybody can, of the, any 80s and 90s books, and see if anybody can remember them or whatever.
Like I said, I bought books. I never stopped buying books, and I bought some in the 80s and 90s, but I didn't buy all the ones everybody else did. You know, I was, you know, a lot of times I was buying stuff that I just passed up in earlier times, or reprints, but there was always comics I liked, but at the same time, some of those books, those image books that I never read, the early ones, that's some people, that's their prime stuff.
You're 100% right. And, you know, that.
So.
That was the golden age.
And, you know, one thing, when I got to know Dallas, I loved X-Men. I loved them when Dave Cockrum was doing it. I thought those were the greatest. When John Byrne came in, they were even, to me, even better. And I continued to read it when Paul Smith was doing it, even though I didn't like him as well.
Mark Silvestri?
Well, never really liked him that much. I thought he was fine, but he wasn't one.
Romita Jr.?
I read him when, for a long time when Romita did it.
Because that's when comic books were affordable.
Yeah, but there was a guy I knew in Oklahoma, and I went home and on leave, and I just made a comment. I says, you know, the X-Men aren't really wearing costumes anymore. Like, Rogue was just wearing spandex. It's a lot of them were just wearing...
Yeah, I remember that, yeah.
They looked like ladies in a dance class. They were wearing spandex with, like, cut-up t-shirts. And I thought, you know, the X-Men aren't really wearing costumes anymore. And, you know, this guy was older than I was. That's why I stopped reading them. Well, when I say that I bought them, but it wasn't like... They weren't top of the pile reads. They were kind of like obligation reads after a while. And I thought, you know, when he said that, though, I thought, I can't stop reading these, because I was always thinking it would come back to what I knew, you know.
There's still Chris Claremont writing.
Yeah, but, yeah, and I like Chris Claremont, but it wasn't the same Chris Claremont I knew in the late 70s. You know, he just kept doing the same beats all the time and long speeches and all those little ticks where he's trying to do everybody's accent, and he would always go off on some tangent, never tie up any loose ends. It was just one plot after another going off, and I'm thinking, you got 1,500 plots, you're not coming back to them. I don't know. It was just like an unrestrained guy with, you know, no control.
Yeah.
And how many times can you bring back Phoenix, and how many times can Alien show up? You know what I mean? Honestly. So, like, I wasn't a big fan. I did stop reading them. And I can tell you when. It was in those characters, the Marauders, you know, started up. They were... Okay. The X-Men got in a fight in Central Park. I got out of the Navy. I was living in Los Angeles. And I bought the issue, and I'm really enjoying it. I'm thinking, well, this is actually kind of neat. And they got in a fight. And then, at the end of that 22-page comic, I completely lost all interest. I said, this is just more of the same. I mean, I understand that they changed everything. Angel was caught, and his wings were cut off, you know, and Kitty couldn't phase, or she couldn't stop phasing, you know, and he's just doing the same thing. And that's when I stopped reading the X-Men. That's when Dallas started reading the X-Men.
So it's synchronicity.
Well, it's synchronicity, but when Dallas and I talk, and it's no slight on anybody, but when I told him that, Dallas says that, that's when I started reading them. So to Dallas, those were key issues. Those were, to him...
Pass the torch, man.
Yeah, pass the torch. But like I said, when I look at those books, all I think is, oh, God, it was just dreadful and just... But I guess that's the thing. I remember when... There was a guy that had a store He sold those metal figures, you know, the old military figures and the fantasy stuff that he used in Dungeons and Dragons. He was an artist. He was a Vietnam vet, and he and I became friends. And he had a table at this convention that John Byrne was at. And I was talking to him, and he said, "That guy over there is an artist?" "Yeah, yeah, he did X-Men, I'm told." "Yeah, he did the X-Men. He's really good." And all this guy said was, "To me, the old X-Men are the X-Men." When I say that, that's understood, but all I was thinking, man, you missed so much, is all I could think. I didn't say it to him, but I kept noticing guys older than me would always say that, you know, like the Neil Adams Batman to him was Batman, and, you know, he never read any of the other stuff. Well, you missed the Marshall Rogers run, and you missed Walt Simonson's Manhunter, which was in Batman. You know, there's some things I absolutely love. The Dave Crockerham and John Byrne X-Men, to me, are still the greatest comics, you know. And
do you like those better than the Jack Kirby ones?
I didn't really like the Jack Kirby
ones. Oh, my God.
I don't want to say that I read them.
What about the Warner Roth issues?
No, I don't like those at all. Now, I see, again, Dallas likes those.
Yeah, I grew up, that's the ones I first bought. Cry Banshee, or whatever the cover was.
Well, like I said, those were roots to the stuff I liked. one book I wish I had was, and I saw it in Otway Park, Texas, was the King Size X-Men one where they fought the Avengers and Jack Kirby drew it.
Yeah.
That one I love. And like I said, I haven't read all of Jack Kirby's X-Men. I just pick them up, you know, reprints once in a while. I didn't hate them, but they weren't like, you know.
What about the Steranko issues?
Yeah, those are pretty neat.
And the Neil Adams ones?
Yeah, well, I didn't really see Neil Adams too much. I've seen some reprints, and those were good. But I didn't really read those. I never, like I said, it was spotty in Oklahoma.
You said Marvel was spotty distribution. Yeah,
until 74. Next thing you know, it was Marvel Palooza, you know. So.
There you go.
Anyway, well,
all right, well, yeah,
I guess that's about it. So, I hope you enjoyed phase two of the Mighty Crusaders.
Yeah, take two.
Anyway, thanks for listening. If you could, feel free, if you listen to us through iTunes, give us a rating or review, we'd appreciate it. It helps us out in the rankings and helps other people find the show. And in the meantime,
read more comics.
My name is Mao, and with me as always,
Dr. Morbius
from Parts Unknown.
Question mark?
This is the promo for Slow Robot A Go Go, the B through Z grade movie review podcast.
That's right.
If it's obscure and you've never heard of it and it's horrible, we're your men. We're your men. We're the dudes that are going to review it and talk about it. And you're going to be like, why would they talk about that? And we don't know either.
And then you're going to want to run out and get these movies and pay big money, Blu-ray money to get these movies because they're all great and you're all going
to
love them.
But anyway, go to bunchofdorks.com.